So I'm gonna tell you how to make a traversable wormhole. Now, I'm a theorist, not an experimentalist, so you won't learn how to, you know, actually build one yourself in your garage. That's left as an exercise to the listener. But this is work with Peng Gao and Daniel Jaffers. So there's this idea running around that a lot of people are excited by, that in some sense, maybe, entanglement, quantum entanglement, is equal to or related to geometry. Okay, so one of the reasons why people think this is because of the ADS-CFT duality. And one of the ideas of that duality is that if you have two CFTs that are holographic, that's in what's called the thermal field double state, so this is a sum over the energies of the CFT where you arrange it so that each CFT has the same energy, and in fact, if one is in a given eigenvalue of the energy, the other is in the CPT conjugate. And this thing, in certain large and strongly coupled field theories, is supposed to be dual to a non-traversable Einstein-Rosen bridge that connects two asymptotically ADS universes, and this is marginally not traversable. Is anybody here not familiar with Penrose diagrams? It's okay to admit it, but speak now or forever hold your peace. Okay. So in the Penrose diagram, you can see that if you start here at minus infinity, this line here, if you start very far back, you can just barely not reach the other side. So it looks like a small perturbation to the black hole might open it up. I should say this is in the Hartle-Hawking state. Typically, when you add more matter, which has positive energy, it would cause the wormhole to get longer and would make it even less traversable. All right, now, this makes sense, though, that it's not traversable, because if this ADS-CFT duality is correct, then the two CFTs that are here, the left and right one here, are local quantum field theories living on disconnected universes. So they have no actual interaction between the two sides. They're just entangled. So in fact, the duality requires there to be no interaction. And that would be inconsistent if this were a traversable wormhole, because then you get some non-zero commutation relations between the two sides coming from signals going through the bulk. Okay? So, the fact that it's not traversable should correspond to some bulk principles that enforce that. And what you find, if you look into it, is in order to make it traversable, you'd have to violate something called the average null energy condition. So this says that if I take a null geodesic, an infinitely long null geodesic, and I integrate along it the TVV component of the stress tensor, where V is the direction in which, V is the vector direction in which the null geodesic, can you all see that, points. If I integrate this all up and down the null geodesic, then I need to get so the ANAC says that this is greater than or equal to zero, the average null energy condition. And this principle has actually recently been proven in flat space time by Tom Faulkner and his research group for basically all interacting conformal field theories. And there's GR proofs that say if you assume the average null energy condition holds, then you cannot make the wormhole traversable. Now there's a wrinkle here, though, that comes up in when we try to extend the average null energy condition to curved spacetimes. And that wrinkle is that it only holds on certain null geodesics that are called achronal. So this is supposed to hold on an achronal infinite null curve. I could say geodesic, but achronality is the statement that no two points are time-like separated, and that actually implies that this is a geodesic. So on a typical space-time, the most null geodesics are not achronal, because if it goes to a gravitational field, the gravitational field will typically slow it down, and you just need some other way to cut through the space-time that will allow you to bypass the light ray. But on this space-time, there are achronal null geodesics that are the null geodesics that rule this horizon here. So the horizon has the topology of a sphere, let's say, and for each point of the sphere, there's an infinite null geodesic going from minus infinity here to plus infinity here. And in fact, at the level of free field theory, it's easy to see that so in order to make it traversable, we need to violate this. But it's easy to see that the average null energy condition is going to hold by just doing a Fock-space quantization on the light front of the horizon itself. If you do that, you just expand in creation annihilation operators, and you find that the integral of the energy after subtracting off zero-point energies, which corresponds to normal order, this is always going to be positive. And that's not just true as an expectation value statement. That is literally the ground state of this Fock space. So it's true as an eigenvalue statement. So in the Hartle-Hawking state, you could write this equation. Quantum mechanically. It's not the expectation, this annihilates the state. So it's not that there's quantum fluctuations that make it sometimes positive and sometimes negative. It's exactly zero, and then in other states that are not Hartle-Hawking, it will be bigger. Okay, to see that you need this achronality assumption, one nice example is if you compactify space on a cylinder, then you can get a Casimir effect, which, depending on your boundary conditions and types of fields, you often get a negative energy on the cylinder. And if you now consider a null geodesic which goes round and round and round, I should say this is a drawing of space at one time. So with time, it's a static manifold that just goes round and round and round. It keeps picking up this negative energy, and there's no positive term to counterbalance it. So the average null energy condition is false, but this isn't an achronal geodesic. OK? because it has points that are time-like separated to itself. If instead I consider geodesics going this way, I find that it's satisfied. And there's a nice paper.
So which way is time there?
This is a diagram with no time in it. This is space at one time when I was showing time by the actual time dimension wiggling around my chalk here. It's plotting time with time, yes. So there's a nice paper by Graham and Olam where they discuss the semi-classical achronal averaginal energy condition. And even though it looks a lot weaker than the, even though it looks like this achronality assumption is a significant restriction, they show that you can still prove a lot of the GR theorems like non-traversability of wormholes that you would have want, that you could prove with just the stronger ANAC. That actually happens in a very interesting way where you prove that generically, you can prove generically there are no achronal null geodesics, but that very fact that there aren't any implies all the results you wanted. So almost looks trivial, but it isn't. Okay. But of course, the Hartle-Hawking state is not a generic state, it's a very special state. So we do get these achronal null geodesics. So if there were negative energy and we could violate this, we'd get traversability, but at the moment it looks like we can't. Now, in a moment, I'm going to explain why we can after all, but let me ask if there's any questions about this background material.
Are there assumptions about the quantum field theory that you're going to, from which you're looking at these violations, or? You said that it's been proven for CFT with
It's been proven in flat space time. Well, I mean, I'll tell you how I'm going to violate it in just a moment. Just, you'll see. All right, so I'm going to do something actually which may look a bit cheap, but I think it's going to turn out to be profound. And I promise you it's not quite as cheap of a trick as it looks like at the beginning. So what I'm going to do, since consistency says if these two CFTs don't interact, there can be no traversability, I'm going to turn on an interaction between the two sides. So I'm going to turn the interaction on and off for a certain time interval on both sides. I'm going to write this as a double trace thing. So the interaction, there's several things we could do here, but I'm just going to take a time integral and a space integral times a coefficient that is time varying, because I'm turning this on and off, of some operator sitting on the right CFT, so this is a local operator on the right CFT, times another one that's a local operator on the left CFT. Okay? So my t and x coordinates, I'm using them on both these sides together. Time goes up on both directions the way I'm doing this. And we're going to make some requirements. First, I'm going to require that the dimension of this thing be less than d over 2. This ensures that this guy is a relevant perturbation. So we just don't have to worry about this being defined in the ultraviolet. I'm going to require that the operator O is single trace. This corresponds in the duality to saying that each of these things corresponds to the limit of a bulk field phi. So this is the limit of a bulk field phi as it approaches this side, and this is the limit of a bulk field as it approaches the other side. So we turn on this time-dependent interaction, and this allows bulk fields to jump from one side to the other. What do I mean? Well, suppose we have a particle that's on this side, and it hits this boundary. It can couple with this interaction. It can be annihilated on the left side and appear on the right side, and it'll come out here. Now, here's the point where I need to be to make sure you don't think I'm doing something stupid. Of course, if things can directly teleport from the left side to the right side, then you can send information from one side to the other. But that is not what I mean by a traversable wormhole. That does not go through the wormhole. It just goes through the boundary. The statement is that for one sign of this interaction, this opens a wormhole in the interior. So once you take into account the one-loop quantum effects, you get that in addition to things being able to teleport around, the interior also opens up and you can send a signal through the middle. Since in this holographic limit, the bulk theory corresponds to a local theory of gravitation, you can tell whether you sent the signal through the middle or around the outside. So why is this possible? The reason why it's possible is that it changes the commutation relations. On H. So that's no longer a kernel. So when we talk about causality on this manifold, we want to use the actual notion of causality corresponding to how the quantum fields propagate. So if these two boundaries interact, then it means that the quantum fields, their two-point function is corrected, and if you calculate the commutation relation of phi with itself, of phi here with phi here, you'll find that in addition to the usual term from it being null separated in this direction, you'll find that there's a correction term coming from the fact that it could propagate through here.
These are disconnected, right? I mean, they're topologically disconnected.
They're topologically disconnected, but they directly interact by this.
Means that somehow the causal structures of one are related to the causal structure of another through some other external.
Right. So the causal structure. So one way to get a causal structure is through looking at the bulk metric. But I'm saying that's no longer the correct causal structure to look at.
So you're putting in some other boundary causal structure which supersedes that.
Yes, or we're adding more. So the old causal structure is a partial ordering on the set of points. We're introducing some new comparison relationships so that two things are now, one point is to the future of the other. If you can draw a time-like curve that either goes through the bulk or that passes through this. And that's the correct thing to do when you're dealing with quantum field theory, because it tells you where the commutation relations are on this, how they behave here. So if you redo the Fox space calculation, you'll find that because of the changed commutation relations, this is no longer the ground state. The energy of the ground state shifts away from zero, and it shifts at linear order in H. So for one sign of H, it can be chosen to be negative. I'm going to draw what happens here. And the point is, it's the rule of quantum field theory that if it's not achronal, we don't need to satisfy the original energy condition anymore. So this doesn't contradict anything we know. So once it becomes traversable, Now it looks like the space-time looks like this. So there's a window. If this is left-right symmetrical, then it happens on both sides. Now there's it opens a little bit. There's a delta V. Actually, delta U in the coordinate system I'm using. It's a delta U shift of the a gap between the future horizon on this side and the past horizon on this side, so that if you send in a signal early enough, it looks like it could make it to the other side. So when we do this, what happens? I'm going to draw the interactions back in. So we're interacting here and here. So we're starting with the Hartle-Hawking state down here. So the state is unperturbed from Hartle-Hawking until we hit these interactions. After we hit these interactions, the effect of them is to make a negative energy pulse that falls across the horizon. And it's the gravitational defocusing caused by this negative energy pulse that causes the wormholes to open. Now, it's critical that we view this interaction as an actual source that we're turning on the boundary, and not just as a change of the state we're considering. Because if we just consider another state in the same algebra of this Fock space, then none of them violate the ANAC. And the way you can see this is if I had just started with this state that had negative energy pulses to the future, and I evolved it back in time without turning on these sources, I would find that that it bounces off and becomes a positive energy thing coming down here, and that the positive energy would cancel out the negative, would be bigger than the negative energy, and cause the original energy condition to be satisfied. So by turning on the sources, this doesn't happen. They just emit negative energy. So you could say, how do we know? Well, nothing prevents it from happening, but to be sure it happened, we did an explicit calculation. So what's this explicit calculation? So first of all, we picked a BTZ black hole, which is a three-dimensional space-time, because that's particularly easy to calculate in, because it's just because you can get it by identifying points in the hyperbolic plane, where the two-point functions are easy to calculate. And we did this with spherical symmetry. And we picked the scalar field. So these simplifying assumptions made it easy to do the calculation, and so we explicitly confirmed for various choices of dimension and test function of source function H that this could be negative. But these assumptions are just assumptions that make it easy to do the calculation. And once we know it works, it seems obvious that it should work in more complicated settings as well. So I should also point out that if you want to calculate the change of mass of this black hole due to this sending in of energy, we can calculate that by Instead, we want to look at the integral from 0 to infinity, where 0 is the bifurcation surface here, of TVV times V dV. This is the flux of Killing energy across the horizon. So this is a different integral. The change of mass of the black hole is a different integral than this is, which has no V in it. And therefore, in principle, by choosing your test function, you could make it so that this has a different sign than this. However, for the particular solutions we looked at, where we just choose nice natural test functions, they have the same sign. And so in our solution, we found that, that this guy is negative, which means there's a negative flux of mass across the black hole. And by the first law applied to black holes, where dE is the same as this dm here, you can, and T is the temperature of the black hole, you can work out that the change of entropy is also negative. So what's going on here, from the boundary perspective, we had two entangled systems, we coupled the two sides, and they used the coupling to become less entangled by sharing information with each other. It's not physically that surprising from the CFT side that they would lose entropy. But what is interesting, what was originally surprising from the CFT side is this traversability phenomenon where you can send in a signal here and the same thing will reach the other side. And since gravity couples universally to fields, it doesn't have to be the same kind of field that we use to couple here. If this guy here was an interaction of a phi field, this guy here that traverses, we could excite a chi field, and chi will come out here at late times. If you ask how early this has to be, you have to send the signal in about, this is about r log hr over L Planck, where r is the radius of the light crossing time of the black hole solution. So this, if I ignore this h here, which is this coupling here, this looks like what people call the scrambling time. That is the time that it takes on the CFT side for the information to scramble so that a perturbation mixes with all the degrees of freedom of the system. And then there's a coupling, and then we have to wait the scrambling time again on this side, and it comes out. It's this delay that guarantees that this solution doesn't actually violate principles of causality. You could imagine trying to construct this sort of space-time in a single asymptotic universe, where the black holes are connecting two sides, but the trouble is, you have to start with two very carefully entangled black holes. So that's delicate, but let's suppose that can be done. Then the trouble is these two black holes have to interact with each other. And so that interaction would have to be implemented by sending a signal from one to the other. So the idea is you take Hawking radiation out of the one black hole, you dump it into the other black hole, and somehow this thing becomes traversable. But this has to go at the speed of light on the outside. And if you look at this diagram where we did the same thing in asymptotically ADS spacetime, you see that you had to jump in before the interaction, and you pop out after the interaction. So if you tried to construct this as a wormhole to get to the Andromeda galaxy or something, you'd find that you could do it, but the time delay to get through would be longer than the time it takes you to send a signal, which is necessary for the solution to exist. So you can't actually use it as a warp drive to go faster than light. And so what I made sure we wrote in our paper was that this was like getting a bank loan, that you can only get one if you can prove to the bank that you didn't need it. So it's the same with a traversable wormhole. You can have it, but you have to prove that you didn't need it. Now, yes.
If you just look at the chi operator in the little diamond in the center.
Oh, in here?
Yeah.
Yes.
So how will the HKLL sort of fuzzy construction formula look for that? Will it be equally spread on both sides or what?
Well, so the HKLL, yes. I don't think anybody's really studied this yet, but if you just have one of these sides and you did HKLL, well, I mean, they couple. So I guess if you have both of the CFTs, since HKLL people usually believe you can reconstruct the causal wedge, in this case, the causal wedge of both sides actually intersect. So presumably, if you did HKLL properly, you could see the whole thing going through. But I should tell you something peculiar about this solution. In the holographic limit, where the Newton constant is small, effectively, this gap here scales. And this scales like GH bar. So this scales with the Planck length. So you might at first think, okay, you've opened the wormhole, but you've done so only by this narrow Planckian window. How do I know I can actually get through this thing? But here's where Lorentz symmetry is helpful, because the original space-time was boost invariant. To get through this narrow window, you just need to send in your signal early enough. So from the perspective of somebody going through at this earlier time, even though in the frame of reference we started in, this is a narrow Planckian window, from the perspective of somebody starting at this earlier scrambling time, the wormhole looks like it's wide open. We calculated the back reaction associated with this process to make sure that sending your signal through wouldn't itself close it again. And we found, because if you send an actual particle through, the actual particle is not a test particle. It itself has mass and energy and a gravitational field. We found that if you do send this particle through, it will tend to close up the wormhole so that you can't go the other direction. But it doesn't tend to close the wormhole going the same direction. We also looked at the possibility of an interaction here between the particle and this negative energy flux. And we looked at this in the Iconal approximation, and it looked like there was a regime. As long as you don't send this particle in too early, there's a window. There's some window where the Iconal approximation is valid. And it looks like they can pass through each other without causing trouble. So the window goes from like this to like 3/2 times this time. You can get that from an analysis of Feynman diagrams. And usually in this talk, I do that next, but I think I'd like to save some time to discuss what Melvisaine and Stanford and Yang did. So, another interesting question you could ask is why this solution does not violate the second law of thermodynamics for black holes. As I had argued in the previous paper, that any traversable wormhole would violate the generalized second law, which states that the area plus the entropy on one side is increasing with time for causal horizons. So how would that argument go? It's actually very simple to see that on this diagram. This line here is the causal horizon. So suppose you had a traversable wormhole, and we didn't turn on this interaction, but somehow we still get a traversable wormhole. Then the causal horizon could be defined as the boundary of past of what can be seen by this point at infinity. So this is the event horizon on the right side. Then the second law for a black hole says the area is increasing. The area plus any bulk entanglement entropy outside is increasing as we go up. So the trouble is, if this is a traversable wormhole, then this hits the infinity on the other side. So as it hits the infinity, the area is diverging. It's going to infinity at early times. And so if the area is going from plus infinity to a finite amount, and the entropy term, which is subleading as we approach the boundary, doesn't correct that, then inevitably we're going to be violating the generalized second law. But now, when we turn on the interaction, just like this doesn't really violate the achronal null energy condition, it doesn't really violate the generalized second law either, because in order to consistently talk about the entropy outside, we need to include the other side as well, because information flows across these two sides. So to talk about the generalized, now the causal structure has changed. So because I could send an observer from here to bounce off to this side and reach this point. So if I consider the actual boundary of the past of what reaches this guy, it is, there's another branch of the causal horizon here that comes out on this side. And so the boundary of what can get to this point now doesn't include this segment. So the generalized second law has a loophole here that it can keep on holding even though this is traversable. And that's of course just because we cheated by turning on this interaction, but it's still pretty interesting.
So what is
yes.
So what is S out here? I mean, if you take the time when the both branches are there. Right, if you cut the space-time at a time when you have both branches on the horizon.
Yes, so you'd have to use, for S out, you would have to use, say we're here, then we could consider a slice that includes all the data on both sides. And then we could consider pushing the slice forwards and ask what happens to the entropy. Or we could push it back, and if we push it back far enough, we get a complete Cauchy slice. And presumably the generalized second law would say something like the area here plus the entanglement entropy here is greater than or equal to the initial starting von Neumann entropy of the state. Which we started with a Hartle-Hawking state, so that's zero, but we could imagine starting with some other state where it's not zero. We also looked at what's called the quantum extremal surface. Well, let me back up a bit. Another interesting thing to look at is the holographic entanglement entropy, where the normal rule for the holographic entanglement entropy is you calculate the entanglement entropy on the CFT side by looking for the area of an extremal surface in the bulk. So if we were just doing that on its original solution before we turned on the interaction, it says that the entropy of this thermal field double state is given by the area of this bifurcation surface. Here, we have an interaction between the two sides, so we have to make a choice as to whether we want to find the surface that calculates the entanglement entropy on one side before or after this interaction. We can also ask about during, but that's more confusing. More complicated anyway. So if we ask about the entanglement entropy beforehand in the Hartle-Hawking state, since this is an unperturbed, since the space-time is the same up until we reach this spot here, if we are looking before, then we should just look at this extremal surface that's here, and it's the same entropy we had before. But if we want to calculate the entanglement entropy afterwards, then we should instead calculate using, well, it wasn't totally obvious what to do when there's the source here, but one thing we could do is just look at the quantum state above the source and then ask what we would have done if we'd evolved back and there was no source at all. And that's what should get us the same as the entanglement entropy here. So if you do that, we found that the holographic entanglement entropy surface it ends up moving upwards. It moves upwards, and it's saturated to first order in H, but at second order, it moves upwards. And to calculate the location of this surface, we need to extremize, since this involves quantum corrections to the bulk, we need to extremize this area plus the outside entropy and not just the area. Because the extremal area surface is always the same, it's just right here. Okay, I want to say something before I quit about what Maldesane and Stanford and Yang did. I don't have as good notes for that, but what they did was important enough to be worth discussing. So, because they improved this argument in a lot of different ways. So, one thing they did was that they extended this to something called the SYK model, which corresponds to ADS2. But they did a bunch of other things, interesting things too. So we speculated in our paper that this was somehow related to quantum teleportation. So the idea is the signal gets through the bulk, there's some interaction on the boundary, something got through you didn't think should got through, but the two sides are entangled. It sort of smelled a lot like quantum teleportation. But my main contribution discussion section was to get my collaborators to tone that down, because there all seem to be some obvious differences too. One of the things being that this is a quantum interaction. And so the usual idea of quantum teleportation is the classical interaction plus entanglement lets you transmit qubits. Whereas this looks like a quantum interaction that is causing this sort of Casimir effect, like negative energy in the bulk, it looks like a quantum effect that's translating, that's sending the qubits through. But Maldesane, Stanford, and Yang made this. They made this precise by considering the case where they sort of consider the simpler case where you just act at one instant of time with a unitary that couples the two sides. So they just acted with a unitary that involved something like this, acting at an instant, which doesn't always make sense depending on the weights of these operators, but sometimes you can make it make sense. And when you do that, what they showed was that as long as you only care whether the information reaches the right side, once you you will trace out the left side after the interaction. And they showed that if you trace out the left side after you do this interaction, that you could have represented the same interaction as just classical communication. So that gives a precise sense in which you can think of this phenomenon as an analog of quantum teleportation, that you can manage to make this work even when you only make the two CFTs talk to each other by classical communication. As long as you only care what comes out on the other side, and if Alice is sending a message to Bob, once we've done the protocol, we only care whether Bob gets the message, and we don't care anymore about Alice's CFT. Yes?
This map between the two boundaries is one sort of, so in the way you've drawn it, because it's just two-dimensional, you're just fixing the time, and you're saying, at a given time, you know, that it's just, you're identifying the two points at a given time, but there's infinite number of maps that you could have made.
Of course.
Which are not, it's just a choice of coordinates that you've made in this case. So for every such choice of, every mapping of boundary to another, to the other, you'll have a different, set of theories, right? So how do you, is there any canonical choice or?
No, I don't think it's all that canonical. I think there's a wide variety of things you can do. We just picked one that was reasonably simple. Of course, it breaks the Killing symmetry of the manifold, which pushes time forwards on one side and backwards on the other side. I should say, originally, my collaborators tried to make this work for the time, for a time-independent interaction. But the reason why we switched to this time dependent interaction that you turn on and off is that in the time independent case, it looked like you tend to get a non-regular quantum field theory state on the bifurcation surface. So it was it didn't give rise to a well-defined quantum state of the interior. But if you're going to turn it on and off, I think the main, there's no particularly one canonical nice way to do this, to get back to answering your question. But I think the point is that this is a sort of a generic phenomenon. So however you turn it on and off, generically, either you've made a traversable wormhole or you've picked the wrong sign of your interaction. If we just flipped your interaction by sending h to minus h, now it's a traversable wormhole. So just generically, this happens at linear order, that one or the other sign of your interaction will open things up. So because of this connection to quantum teleportation, they could also get a limit between of how much quantum bits can be sent through. That wasn't the limit that we were able to see by this iconal argument, but the basic, it's not due to back reaction in the interior, what we were worried about. It's due to the fact that this only works because the two sides have entanglement. And so you think about the entanglement between the two sides as being a resource. And when you send information across the wormhole, you lower the amount of entanglement of the two sides in the modes that you're in, just the modes that are associated with these operators. And once the correlation that you're exploiting goes to zero, you can't send any more information. They did other interesting things, and they did so many different things in this paper. They also argued that you could use this to talk about how getting information out of the black hole doesn't violate no cloning. They drew a bunch of nice Penrose diagrams I won't try to replicate about how if you tried to argue that if you took the Hawking radiation that came out of the black hole and thought of it as forming the CFT system on the other side, Then you asked all of these old classic questions about what happens if you try to measure the information that fell into the black hole from the Hawking radiation, and then jump in and try to see the same qubit cloned in the interior because it fell in. They showed that whenever that happens, this process of interacting the two sides involves snatching the qubit out of your grasp before you can get it. And that isn't even all they did. They also explained why this happens from the field theory side. So everything I told you was really, even though I expressed it in ADS-CFT language, you could really think of this as purely a bulk gravitational thing. I could just think of this as a bulk boundary condition. So it's really a pure gravity side, and that left it mysterious what would happen, why this interaction would occur on the CFT side. Why? It seems almost miraculous. You, from the perspective of the CFT, I drop this guy in. It looks from the left side like it thermalizes. I wait until it's mixed with all the information. I couple this to a thermofield double system, and then it still looks thermal, and then suddenly the information pops out again. So Douglas Stanford actually figured out that this actually happens even with classical systems. You can even prove that it happens at the level of classical phase space. And so it's a sort of chaos facilitated quantum teleportation. Usually we think of quantum teleportation as something where you set up a very precise protocol and you have to do that protocol, otherwise it doesn't work. But here, you know, one example that's come up, and you can imagine having two cups of water or something isolated from the outside environment. If they're in the thermofield double state, you could imagine that you tap on this cup, let the information scramble with all the degrees of freedom. Then you can couple any of the degrees of freedom of this cup to this side, and we wait a bit longer, and we hear the tap come out again. Why did this happen? Well, Douglas showed with a argument involving the Poisson bracket, which I don't have in my notes here, so I won't try to actually write it out. But the basic idea was that if you calculate the effect of the initial tap on the corresponding late time degrees of freedom, and you calculate it, its effect with the Poisson bracket, because this is the thermofield double, you end up finding that there's it ends up being a sum of squares. And so it always reinforces. There's always constructive interference. Yeah. And so you got to do it at the right time, though, because if you wait before this is scrambled with all the degrees of freedom, then the degrees of freedom you coupled probably don't transmit any information, and the sum of squares is nearly zero. On the other hand, if you wait too long, then the linearity of the perturbation assumption is no longer valid. And you'd have to go to higher orders where this doesn't occur. So they predicted, just as a generic, non-holographic prediction, that if you did an experiment like this, that you'd see the correlation would go up and then down again as a function of the amount of time you wait on both sides. You have a question.
Yeah, what are the classical
thermofield doubles? It's just a state where, let's suppose I think of this as a bunch of molecules, or let's just draw a bunch of atoms. So we have some thermal probability distribution of all these atoms. All we do is we do a CPT conjugation of the state. And we say whenever the molecules are in this state, any specific state, they're in the corresponding CPT conjugate state on the other side. So you just reverse, so you basically just reverse the direction of time, and then you do a probability distribution over all the thermal configurations on one side. Yeah, so this is not just a quantum concept.
So you're saying that basically, everything that you did making it traversable, it sounds like you only need the correlation part of entanglement. You don't need the fact that it's actually violated by any particular thing. Because what your classical homophily level is just literally correlation.
Well, of course, we did this at the classical level. We quantum teleportation is what shows you can transmit qubits. So if we're doing everything classically, then of course classical communication is enough to communicate a C-bit. But it's sort of surprising. It also works at the quantum level. But this is just a conceptual argument that goes up and down. The nice thing about this bulk calculation is that it allows you to actually calculate how it appears in a very coherent manner. Although there's a puzzle about this. Normally, when you do quantum teleportation, normally when you do quantum teleportation, you expect to get the exact same qubit out at the end. Here, it's kind of a funny thing. This was pointed out to me by Lenny Susskind's student. She's on the market right now, by the way. Hint, hint. She said that she pointed out that if you go through this traversable wormhole, you get older. So you don't actually get the exact same quantum information you dumped into the wormhole. You get some slightly processed, aged information, if you will. And that's very peculiar and makes it difficult to relate it to more traditional quantum teleportation protocols where this doesn't happen.
Well, in the usual protocols, though, usually you have to apply some unitary correction at the end or something.
Yeah.
Is this aging process unitary or is it actually degrading information?
Well, it does degrade information because in principle you could interact with other quanta as you're passing through the wormhole. So in principle it could degrade things. Like if you happen to emit a photon while you're on this journey and it hits the singularity. And in general, I mean, if you just have you have to actually evolve the wave equation through this space-time. And it may not be trivial. But in general, you'll find, you construct a big pulse of one species coming in, that you'll find some sort of slightly deformed big pulse of that species coming out, assuming you aim it well. Yes?
So the fact that if you put in a pulse, like you were saying, at the bottom on the left, and then it reemerges right at the end on the right. Do I understand correctly that that's coming from just because the two surfaces are basically time, because they're in the thermal field state, they're time reversed with each other, so you put it in over here, whatever scrambling happens, you go up this side, exactly the corresponding B scrambling, basically.
It does, ultimately it follows of course, this construction is using the fact that it's a thermofield double, but it's by no means obvious just from the fact that it's a thermofield double on the CFT side that it should come out in exactly in a time symmetric way. In fact, I don't think it does exactly come out in a time symmetric way.
If you have to insert these two operators on the two boundaries. Does this one have to be inserted? If this one is inserted at a certain time t here, does this one have to be inserted at the same point? So that the time t from the lower boundary on this side is the same as the displacement t from the upper boundary on this side in order for the descrambling to work.
That's what happens holographically. That there's a sharp time, window that's approximately what you just said, that's sort of centered around what you just said to make it work. But at the level of this purely field theory argument, there isn't a sharp window. It's just some expectation that's probably exponentially growing and then eventually turns around again. So the parallel here is not there's more that can be said in the holographic case, so the parallels are not perfectly exact. I should say that I've said all the things I'm going to say that aren't answering questions, so should give people a chance to escape if they don't want to.
Okay.
Right. I guess that also means you should thank Aaron Tracy.
Questions? Yes.
Yeah. So this generally second law that it just manages to escape. Does it have a nice boundary interpretation? Like, there's a nice boundary meaning of generally second law.
This has been an active area of my research for some time, and so the trouble is the generalized second law would have to correspond to some sort of coarse-grained entropy on the boundary side, because it's increasing, whereas the fine-grained entropy stays the same with time, assuming we don't couple the two sides like we're doing here, the fine-grained entropy of the CFT will stay the same. And therefore, if I form a black hole from collapse and the area is increasing, that increasing area must represent some sort of coarse-grained description of the CFT side. And Netta Engelhardt, I had a proposal with Will Kelly about what that coarse-grained entropy might be on the CFT side, and Netta Engelhardt and I recently showed that was wrong. We have a holographic proposal to interpret the increase of area for the apparent horizon that looks like it does work, but we were unable to figure out a coarse-grained interpretation of the increase of area for the causal horizon.
Okay, just to really clarify for myself, before you turn, if you didn't turn on this interaction, then isn't the generalized second law, is it just the thing in the generalized second law, is it just the entanglement entropy of one CFT with the other?
In the killing case.
Yeah, okay.
In the killing case where it's stationary along the horizon.
Okay.
Yes. Then it's just the fine-grained answer. So what Netta and I did is we found if there's a marginally trapped surface, I should draw where this is. This is a kind of messy diagram now, so I won't. But if there's a marginally trapped surface in the bulk, we found that the area of this marginally trapped surface can be viewed as, you can imagine there's a coarse-grained entropy where you hold fixed all the information in this region, and then you construct what is the maximum allowed area of an extremal surface in this geometry. So maximizing the fine-grained entropy subject to holding some constraints fixed, that gives you a coarse-grained entropy. And we found that the maximum area extremal surface is actually null-separated from this marginally trapped surface, and in fact has the exact same area. So that implies that the area of this marginally trapped surface is a coarse-grained entropy where you're holding the data in this outer wedge we called it fixed, or you call it the marginal wedge if it's the one outside the marginally trapped surface. And then we argued that at least perturbatively around the killing horizon that this has a holographic interpretation where you're asking yourself, suppose you want to do an experiment on the CFT. But you're only allowed to touch the CFT after this initial moment of time T0, corresponding to this light-like separated. You send in a null surface from here to find your marginally trapped surface. So what can you do? You can turn on sources, and you can measure observables that come out. But we insisted that whatever you do, it has to propagate locally in the bulk. So we're not going to allow you to do crazy things like time folds or, you know, non-locally create a black hole in the interior. We're just going to allow you to turn on sources and let things propagate out. Then we argued, using HKLL, that at least perturbatively around the killing horizon, you could measure everything in this region. So initially, it looks like you can't because the causal horizon is out here. And so HKLL only gets you this stuff. But perturbatively, what you do is the reason why these two horizons are separate is that positive energy stuff was falling across. And so you can use HKLL to figure out what sources correspond to that positive energy stuff and turn them off. And once you've turned them off, you can then, now all of the data here is in the past of the boundary, and you can read it off by HKLL. So that was a lot of words, but if I wanted to sloganize it, I'd say that the area of the marginally trapped surface corresponds to coarse graining, where you maximize the entropy subject to every experiment that could be feasibly measured on the boundary after some moment of time. Yes.
There was this paper like 15 years ago by Horowitz and Maldacena about the black hole final state, where the idea was you would solve
yes.
black hole information by teleporting basically the infalling information out of the horizon. Right. What relation does that bear to this?
I've never thought about that in this connection before, but as far as I know, there's no relation. I mean, they're actually. The final state proposal is extremely radical. They're changing the boundary conditions at the singularity, and it's not obvious that what should even happen with the geometry of the interior. In fact, it's not even obvious how you even can consistently interpret stuff behind the horizon. But I will say,
isn't the basic idea that the ingoing qubit gets entangled with the ingoing qubit? The basic idea that the ingoing qubit gets entangled with the Hawking photon and then gets measured, a measurement of that communicates that info to another Hawking photon.
Right, so I mean, I guess you could say it's almost like, it's sort of similar, except we're coupling things here instead of at the singularity somehow.
Yeah,
but,
and the two photons, one, in their case, one was ingoing, one was outgoing, into the horizon. One was
but here, it's like they're turning on a boundary condition that's like up here or something. I don't know. I mean, conceptually, that was an attempt to explain how information gets out of the black hole. And it is possible that this reveals some stuff about it, because this is a way of opening up the horizon and seeing what's in there. So it represents a sort of possibility of confirming this idea that the entanglement induces the geometry of the black hole interior by saying you could interact the two sides, and now you can probe some of the region behind the horizon that used to be inaccessible. Now, I used to be skeptical. I'm not sure what to think about this. I used to be skeptical of this idea that you get geometry just from entanglement, because I think it thought it violated the linearity of quantum mechanics. I argued that in a paper with Don Maroff. Here, it looks like we can now operationally test that entanglement gave rise to a wormhole by sending in a signal here, and it reaches the other side. And you can now probe what went in. But of course, now that we've re-expressed everything in terms of CFT statements, the interpretation is linear in quantum mechanics. So it's unclear whether I should take that as a refutation of my original beliefs or not.
So I have another question about this recent paper by Maldacena and Pearson
yeah.
SYK, and it's more like one-sided case in some sense, and that how does it fit into your story of...
How recent was this paper?
This pure state in SYK paper.
I'm not sure I read that paper carefully enough. This is a different paper than the one with Douglas Stanford.
No,
it's the same paper?
No, it's more recent. I think he wrote with one of his students.
I see. Well, the trouble is, I didn't read that paper, so I don't think I can answer your questions about it. Any other questions?
Well, let's thank Aaron again.